time once again for Community Forum, and we're very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning, Jerome Gold. Jerome Gold is author of 10 books, including Sergeant Dickinson, which was based on his experiences in the U.S. Army Special Forces during the Vietnam War. He is the co-founder and publisher of Black Heron Press. From 1991 to 2006, he worked as a juvenile rehabilitation counselor in a prison for children here in Washington State. And he is here to talk about his new book, which is based upon his work at that job, Paranoia and Heartbreak, 15 Years in a Juvenile Facility. Jerry, thank you very much for coming in and spending time with us this morning.
Well, thank you for having me.
Start out and tell us, what was the motivation in writing your book, Paranoia and Heartbreak?
Well, my motivation in publishing it, at least, was I would like the public to look at these kids that I knew as human beings. Like all of us, their lives are shaped by forces beyond their control, historical and social forces. Personality aside, I think... Well, I used to see them in my own mind. I used to conceive of them as conduits for violence. I dealt mostly with kids who had committed violent crimes. And when I mean a conduit for violence, what I mean is that violence was done to them that they could not prevent. And in return, without realizing they were repeating what had been done to them, they did violence. I remember one boy particularly who was doing exactly what he had seen his father do. Once his father, who was estranged from his mother, came back and smashed the window out with the palm of with his hand. The boy had also seen the father chase his mother around with a knife. The boy, some years later, chased his sisters around with a knife. And I asked the boy whether he realized he was doing what his father had done. He did not realize that and did not accept that. So I asked him whether he'd ever broken a window out with his hand, and he said he had, but he still didn't accept that he was repeating what his father had done. He wasn't a stupid kid, it's just he didn't want to see that. And in my opinion, he didn't want to see it. Probably my view, excuse me, probably my view of kids as conduits for violence is really goes back to my view as people as the enactors of historical as victims of historical forces and the enactors of historical process. The book came about, published or not. It's really my diary. I kept a journal of all the time I was there. Throughout my life, at least in my adult life, I've kept a journal when I've been under stress to relieve stress or troubled by something I'm trying to understand. I've always found that by writing something out, I can understand it more clearly, or at least I often can. If I can't at the moment, maybe I can go back later and look at it again. It was some years before I thought about publishing it. My original intent was to write a book, either a collection of essays about kids in prison, or one long essay that would be book length. But I was talking about that to a friend of mine. He, after having listened to me for some time talk about these kids, he suggested that if I already had a diary, I might look at that. And after that, I started thinking about it. But it wasn't until the last year or two that I was there, probably the last couple of years, that I was that I worked out there at the place I call Ash Meadow, that I really started thinking seriously about it, about publishing the diary itself.
What made you choose a job there in the first place?
I drifted into it. Story of my life. I was on active duty during Desert Shield, the prelude to Desert Storm, the first Gulf War, and somebody I knew who was also on active duty. We were reservists who were on active duty. And he asked me what I was going to do after I was separated from service. My intent was to go on unemployment for a while and do some writing, just kind of relax. He suggested that I go out to where he worked, which was Ash Meadow, and apply there. He didn't tell me much about it, but he did say he thought I would like it. He said that if I applied there now, so that would have been January or February of 1991, that they wouldn't be hiring till spring. I still have a few months. So I went out there and I was interviewed, and they called a couple of days later and hired me. So even through the interview, that interview went for a couple hours. Even then, I didn't know what the job would entail. They didn't tell you in those days that now it's part of the job description that you have to be able to withstand verbal abuse. They didn't mention it then. And of course, that was the toughest part at the beginning. Because kids get in your face. They don't know you. They want to test you. They want to see how you react. So that's, even though they abused me verbally at first, I became fascinated with them almost immediately. Your training, at least at that time, your training was that you worked, your first 3 days there, you worked in three different units. We call them cottages. Other institutions may call them lodges, but we call them cottages. So you work a shift in three different units. And the first shift I worked, it was just a six-hour shift for me, was in a sex offender unit, male sex offenders. And a boy was doing what they call a committing offense group, and that's kind of a ritual where the boy talks about the offense he had committed that got him locked up, and other kids and staff sit around him and question him about that. So he was doing his committing offense group, and he mentioned that when he was in foster care, he and some other boys had beaten up still another boy, and that he had punched him in the groin, trying to injure his genitals. He said he got the same thrill from that as when he had beat up other kids. And he said there was some sort of comment he made. I don't remember exactly what it was, but something to the effect of, you know, it's like when you get hit, you like that too. And other kids didn't know what he was talking about. And so one of the counselors had to stop and explain what sadomasochism was. But it was really interesting that this boy had no idea that he was different from the other kids. They were all sex offenders, but his mentality was different. And then the same boy, during his group, talked about having tried to commit suicide twice, once by jumping off a bridge, and once by drinking a quart or a fifth of whiskey just as fast as he could, hoping to die from alcohol poisoning. So these were serious attempts. These were not gestures. And that relationship between wanting to do harm to others, wanting to do harm to self, was fascinating to me also. I had been playing with those ideas in literary terms for some time, and I was right, at least with some people.
Talk about the facility that you worked at briefly, and give us a picture for the kids, an overall picture of the kids that are there.
Well, the facility was constructed originally back in the 60s for youth at risk, meaning kids who a judge felt kids who had done some minor stuff, probably misdemeanors, and the judge felt that they were drifting away from the mainstream of society, and he would put them there for a few months and get them back into shape. Or parents could send their kids there. Some parents did for a short period of time. Later in the 70s, it got a lot of homeless youth. It was only in the late 70s, this is before my time, but this is what I've been able to reconstruct from people who were there then. In the late 70s, they started sending convicted felons, juveniles who had been convicted of felonies there. It became an actual prison then. And then in the 80s and 90s, with the rise of gang culture and gangs being involved with drug sales. Then they got some pretty serious felons there. Kids who had not only drug sales, but kids who also killed people. Kids who had done everything. They've done all the blue-collar type of crime that that adults do. I say blue-collar because there was nobody there for that I know of for embezzlement. They weren't in a position to embezzle. I had heard that there had been a kid there who was a counterfeiter before my time. That is, he was kind of an apprentice to an adult counterfeiter. But usually they're kind of gross crimes. The individual codges, from the inside, it's more like, they look like a summer camp. Even from the outside, it looked like a summer camp. The big difference is that only the adults have the keys. Kids are locked in. The codges are always locked. And so you're locked in or you're locked out. It takes a staff to open the door. The rooms, depending on which cottage you're in, the rooms may be always locked. So the kid could be locked in or locked out. Again, it takes a staff to open the door. I worked in maximum security for, seven or eight years. And that's how I was in maximum security. Before that, I worked in other units in which the room doors were not necessarily locked. And I say rooms rather than cells because they look like rooms. They look like small bedrooms, similar to if you have a teenager at home who has his own room, his room may very well look like one of Ash Meadow. Except in maximum security, they can decorate the rooms. Not necessarily tasteful either, but they can decorate the rooms. The idea, at least my idea, and I think the idea of many of the staff who had been there for a relatively long time, was that you try to prepare the kids to get out and not to reoffend. Later that changed in that the institution adopted a therapy that kind of brushed away all other therapies. And the idea then was to train the kid to get along in what they called his milieu. We could say environment. They like to use the word, the people who brought this training in like to use the word milieu. But what that meant, of course, is you train a kid to be a good prisoner, and you just don't think about what happens when he gets out. This is one of the frustrations for me, at least, and for many of us, actually, about what had happened later at Ash Meadow. And a lot of people left, including me. for that, well, that was a major reason.
So, what were the other reasons why you eventually left? Because you were there a long time.
Well, I was there 15 years, but actually, when word got around that I was leaving, a couple people who were closing on 30 years thanked me for having helped them out as though I was just temporary help. I love that. I had a pretty good reputation all over campus, and these people just thank me for helping them out. another reason why I left, and probably just more than anything, is that I had grown extremely angry. I had had a girl on my caseload. This is when I was in maximum security. And the institution regulation was that as it covered her, was that if she had good behavior for 45 days, she would transfer to what they call an open unit, meaning another cottage where she'd have a lot more freedoms. And she certainly deserved it. She hadn't had a single infraction. She had had one minor infraction. It was kind of iffy. I was the one who gave it to her. And it was just a test, really. I just wanted to see how she would deal with being punished in a way that wasn't where it wasn't clear that she was being that she had done something wrong. It was a matter of testing her frustration level. But she'd had no other infractions. This is almost unheard of. I suppose on average, each kid in maximum security probably has two or three minor infractions per week. And she'd been there for 6 weeks, and just this one. So the superintendent himself had said, "You know, she's doing good. We'll transfer her." The time came. We had arrangements made with another cottage to accept her. But the administration had to sign off on it. And nobody would sign off. They wouldn't even answer our calls. And finally, the superintendent, after weeks, after the girl had been just waiting, the superintendent, after some weeks of this, did respond and said that one of the associate superintendents, the next level down in the administration, had objected. He didn't say why she had objected. Had objected to the girl's transferring, that she thought the girl should be there for another 6 months in maximum security. This was unheard of at that time. And I remember the girl just crying and wanting to know why. And I couldn't answer. I had no idea what to tell her. It was because somebody who had power wanted it that way. And others who had power didn't oppose it. That was just the beginning. Later, we had a boy there for 27 months. And again, he was great behavior. It wasn't a behavioral problem at all. But at least one of the administrators wanted him there, didn't want to move him to an open unit. So, especially with the girl, because she was on my caseload, but the boy was not. So I got close to her. And I couldn't get rid of that anger that I felt that had happened with her. Part of it was that because I had believed the superintendent when he said we would move her, he didn't talk to her. He talked to me and to my boss. And we told her this is how it was going to be. And then when the superintendent changed his mind, it left us hanging. And I just had this thing about keeping my word, and here I was not able to honor my word. And while the girl didn't blame me, she wouldn't, because I meant a lot to her. I blame myself. And the way I dealt with it was with anger. So that was, I think that happened in 2001 or 2002. I think 2001. And the next 5 years, I just kept thinking about it. I just wasn't ready to leave until finally I was.
What kept you hanging on there for 5 years? Obviously, you were getting something out of it.
I felt that some kids, at least on my case, needed me. I mentioned to another girl, actually a young woman, she was 20 already at the time. I mentioned to her that I was probably going to leave soon, and she just begged me not to. So these kinds of relationships. Later, when she got out, I met her over coffee, and I told her, I was teasing her. I mentioned that she was responsible for my having stayed, and she said, for my having stayed and getting involved with other kids. And she said, well, I just meant for me. You're perfectly free to leave after I left. But finally, I just said that it was enough. I kept the, probably because I was angry, but maybe not. Maybe there was something more to it, because other staff, too, had grown really contemptuous of the administration, as I had. And it wasn't only about my experience with this girl. This therapy that they had brought in, or training that they had brought in that I mentioned before, really angered a lot of people, because they weren't able to do other things that worked. Actually, they could if they lied about it and the administration didn't catch them. So some of them would do the things that they had been doing, especially in one of the mental health units. They would do the things that they'd always done that they knew worked, but they would call it they would just change the vocabulary so that the administration believed that they were doing what they wanted them to do, which did not work. It had been shown that at least it did not reduce recidivism. It did not reduce reoffending. It had been sold to the administration on the basis of that it would reduce recidivism by 57%. But that was a made-up figure. There was no study that said that. And then when the studies were done, it was shown to be ineffective. But others that were effective were killed to make room for this one.
and there was no mechanism from between the administration and people like yourself working at the facilities to get any feedback about the changes they were implementing?
I don't think so. Word came down to us that you either were on board or you leave. They left me alone for the most part because I was doing other training that was required by the state. This thing was not required by the state. The training that I was doing was required by the state. It was called aggression replacement training. And I was the only one on campus doing it. So they pretty much had to leave me alone. And I didn't get the same pressure that everybody else was getting. Well, I did, but I just ignored it. And nobody said anything.
And when you say the administration pushed this, is that the, what would that be for, the Washington, the corrections unit in Washington State, or the governor's office, or, I mean, where does the
one blame, that was required by the state?
Yeah. Where does the blame really lie for implementing that?
The one that didn't work?
Yeah.
With that particular institution?
I guess. Was it just at that institution that was?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. It later was adopted by other institutions, but not to the same extent. When it was adopted by other institutions, it was considered one of several that staff were free to use. But at our institution, it was the one. We had a wonderful group. I wasn't involved with it. Our chaplain was, called Grief and Loss, that kids found really valuable, and chaplain was prohibited from using it any longer because philosophically, it was opposed to this other training.
We are talking with Jerome Gold. He is author of the new book, Paranoia and Heartbreak, 15 Years in a Juvenile Facility. And we're just only got about 8 minutes left. And I wondering if you can actually read a brief piece from your book on page 71 on Saturday, July 2nd. One of the things that blew me away about your book is that it became very clear from the numerous examples that you give from your journals that these kids that are in there, their problems all stem from having been victims and or survivors of violence that occurred to them, and that just kept getting repeated over and over. And if, boy, that doesn't drill home where potential solutions in our society, you know, should be aimed at, I don't know what does. So I was wondering if you could read that segment, just A, to give listeners a taste of what's in your book, and also we're going to let people know about that you're going to be speaking both tonight and this coming Wednesday, so they'll be able to come out and talk to you and listen to your readings.
Okay, great. You want me to begin with Michael Fuentes or with Gigi?
With Gigi, please.
Okay. So Saturday, July 2nd. Gigi told me this morning that she misses the emotional involvement of working with juveniles, although when she was at Ash Meadow, she would often go home after her shift and cry. I realized today, probably from talking with her, that what I like about working with these kids, particularly kids with gang backgrounds, is that I get to experience again some of the emotions I felt in Vietnam and some of the sensations. Michael Fuentes is back after bombing out of Apple Park for refusing treatment. Apple Park was a drug and alcohol rehabilitation center at a different location. He said today that he intentionally failed at Apple Park because he wanted his maximum sentence and was afraid that if he graduated, he would get less. He said also that he was not comfortable with sharing in treatment groups, meaning he did not want to reveal things about his life or family to other residents at Apple Park because he did not trust them not to use his disclosures against him someday. This is a common feeling among the kids we send to the Phoenix program or Apple Park, especially the gang kids. One reason for it is that some of them have committed crimes other than those they've been convicted of and don't want to be charged with them. A second reason is that there may be kids from rival sets in the group who will use in one way or another any information they can get about their enemies. Still a third reason is that gang kids' trust can be won, if at all, only over a long period of time, at least several months. And they do not spend enough time at Apple Park, 1 month, or in Phoenix, 3 months, to give over their trust. Michael said that, other than me, the only person he can talk openly to is a girl he knows from the outside, who is in Peacock Cottage now. When I told him he would get his maximum, August 24th will be his release date, he was visibly relieved. He had been afraid we were still giving him his minimum, which would have put him out of Ash Meadow this Thursday. He said his girlfriend would be getting out a month before he does. You want me to continue? Or?
No, let's stop there just because we have a limited amount of time. So these were all from journals that you kept at the time. And you changed some names to...
All the names of the kids have been changed, and I've disguised them in other ways as well. And all the names of the staff have been changed except for mine. My name's the same. But the only other names that are actual are some of my friends on the outside who pop up in the journal.
So do you believe that facilities like the one you worked in are working, are helping? And also talk about juveniles being tried as adults or juveniles.
In Washington State, a study was published in the early part of this decade showing that, and this is before there was any specialized training, so it was just kids in the system. A study showed that within 12 months after release from parole, kid would go from prison to parole. Within 12 months after release from parole, 67% did not reoffend, which astounded me. Astounded, I think, a lot of people there, because we were working in kind of a low-level despair, just thinking that nothing we were doing was any good. And yet, more than two-thirds of them, did not reoffend, at least after 12 months. What this tells me, and the references to this, to what I just said, are in footnote 2 of my book. but what this tells me is that kids are rehabilitatable. I think all kids who are legally minors should be tried as juveniles. We can't do it in this state. We don't do it in this state. Prosecutors don't want to, and many judges don't want to. One reason, I think, is that if a kid, say, 16, 17 years old, who's done a really bad crime, is tried as a juvenile, he has to be released not later than his 21st birthday. He has to be released from prison then. But maybe he's committed a murder, and so the judge feels that sending a 17-year-old kid to juvenile prison for three and a half years, That's just not enough time. But what some other states have done is that if a kid is sentenced as a juvenile, he can still be held till his 26th birthday. He'll be, after a certain age, he's kept away from younger juveniles. But nevertheless, it does allow a judge some discretion in sentencing. And I think we should look at that. The human brain is not really developed yet in adolescence. Studies done by universities back east, University of Pennsylvania, show that conscience is not really developed, not fully developed until somewhere in our mid-20s. So when we talk about a kid showing knowing right from wrong, or we talk about a kid showing remorse, it's simply not true. In some cases, a kid does know right from wrong, but not fully. And as far as showing remorse, if a kid has just recently committed the crime, he may well be numb for the crime. One thing I noticed with a lot of juveniles is that the things they did to others traumatized them as well. So I remember one girl talking about her nightmares were filled with her own crime. She had not expected there to be so much blood, and she couldn't stop thinking about it. So she was obviously traumatized too. Now, you may think that maybe she should be traumatized. I kind of think that, actually. Somebody who does something that bad should deal with the moral consequences of it. Nevertheless, she's certainly rehabilitatable. I've continued a relationship with her. She stayed with me and my wife for several months last year when she was recovering from a bout of depression. And she's doing very well in her life. It's not necessarily a happy life, but she's married, she has a child, she's going to college. She's trying to lead a middle-class life. That's what she wants.
Well, unfortunately, we are out of time. Talking with Jerome Gold, he is author of the new book, Paranoia and Heartbreak, 15 Years in a Juvenile Facility. And I want to thank you very much for coming in and spending time with us this morning.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.